This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome back to the spooky, spooky podcast.
I hate you.
Not alone. I am your host, Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm still confused. Hey guys, it's Jason.
Was that spookier than last week, do you think?
I think, what, were you Scottish? Were you a Scottish ghost?
I felt like I was a Scottish Transylvanian.
What?
Like,
economic turmoil in Scotland has made you
Count McDracula. That's who I was right there.
Is it so Mick or Mac Dracula?
Mac. Count Mac Dracula. Mac Dracul. That sounds good. That sounds Scottish. Good. Hello, our Scottish friends and everyone else. We're so grateful that you tuned in yet again.
And you're still listening to us.
And you haven't.
I would have already changed the
turned
channel.
Turned it off. Hello. Welcome back. We're happy to be here.
Are we?
I guess. How do we usually start these? I don't know.
Well, usually.
Okay.
You don't make funny noises.
That's true.
And yeah. So, Sam, what are we talking about this week?
Well, before. Okay.
There we go.
There we go.
I got him back on track. We're
but
good.
Really quick, before we get there, thank you for your hard work at that.
You know, I do what I can.
Your diligence. We just want to do a quick reminder before we just dive right in here. If you are looking to contribute a listener story, we do need a few more. Anybody who wants to send one, please send one in. You can do that at notalonepodstories@gmail.com. You can do that up till the 23rd, which is 7 days from the day we're recording this. So about five to six days from when you're going to hear it, depending or when it comes out.
Sammy rambling.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So they can be written. They can be recorded. There are the two options. There's really not a third option there.
Send pictures. We'll try to describe
yes,
them.
Yes, that would be good too. Just act it out. Yeah, send those there. We'll take anything we can get, and we'll let you know what we decide at the end of the day. One person sent in a poem.
Whoa.
Which I haven't let them know yet. I am going to read it on the show.
I'm pretty sure they know who they are now.
You can do poetry. You could, let's just, instead of being like a listener story special, let's just be like a celebration of our listeners. And if you have spooky stories, if you, yeah, what do you think?
Let's just do it. I'm coming with this live. Why not?
Yes. If you have a true story, mark it as a true story. If you have like a 2 or 3 page long, like, I wrote this creepypasta sort of thing, send that too. We're going to tell people during the show. If you have poems, if you have pictures, you could try. It's an audio medium, but still. Anyway, send all of that to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. Thank you for inspiring me.
So we need a couple
and the
more,
listeners.
Huh?
We do need a few
okay.
more.
Otherwise, I'll make up stories and
yeah,
no one wants
we'll
that.
We'll just sit here and do improv games for like 5 hours.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I might delete them all. What?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, so, but that's not why we're here.
Oh, man.
Not today, it's not. No, today we're here because it is the spookiest month of the year. And this subject this week is one that intersects not only with the various interests of both Jason and myself, which we both have individual interests and ones that we share, but it
sure
intersects... It's one specific interest that we're actually not going to talk about this week. We're going to talk about it next week because this is probably going to be a two-parter. I say probably because if we only get 30 minutes in here, I'm just going to kind of go from the top of my head with the rest of it. But I think it'll be fine.
This is definitely a two-parter. Don't worry, guys.
So I have interests. Jason has interests. You, the listener, have interest. And Halloween, that great, great spirit, has interest.
So in the great big Venn diagram of interests...
This episode's all of them.
Oh, God.
It's all of them.
Oh, no.
Or this subject. Again,
can we even handle that?
You know, we can't. No, but we're going to try. So,
as a collective, we can.
As a collective, if each one of us does our part, I'm rambling again.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You're gonna have to cut all of this. This is
no,
great.
I'm
it's
leaving
great.
It all. My editing over the years, year and a half, has gotten severely less critical to the point where now I pretty much just edit out swear words and long pauses. Most everything else stays in. So.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. That's right. What civilization does to you.
Yes. So as I was saying, in time, we will come to find Jason and I's shared interests. But we start not with a shared interest, as far as I know, but with one that is peculiar to me. And that is an affinity for Jewish mysticism. Jason, do you have an affinity for Jewish mysticism?
I have affinity designer, but that's not the same thing.
That's not the same thing.
Oops. I like the Greek stuff.
Greek mysticism? Like the mystery schools and stuff like that?
Yes.
Okay. Do you just mean you like Greek mythology?
Bingo.
Okay. That's not mysticism.
It kind of is.
Mysticism is I don't know what mysticism is actually.
Yeah. See?
But it's like,
pick me whatever
it's
you want.
It's using
to be.
Myth and folklore to create a system, to create an actionable system.
Yeah, same thing, bro. Oracles.
Sure. There you go. Which the Jewish community and culture has done exceedingly well, especially and most famously in their use of Kabbalah, which Kabbalah is a belief system that is enfolded within Judaism, which is meant to explore the relationship between the temporal and the eternal. Now, we're not talking about Kabbalah today. It's one aspect of the subject, but it's not the main subject ourselves. However, that's not to say we never will. For, you know, I went on Instagram. Nope. I've never gone there. I went on Twitter and I said, who's up for some 12th century mysticism? And a lot of people raised their virtual hands. So we might just have to do a really cool,
do a poll next time.
We'll have to do like a mysticism special or like a Kabbalah special or something. But it's just such an interesting way of thought, because it is. It's this idea that there's some sort of eternal force that is consistently creating everything around us, and how does that work? So you get ideas like the 10 emanations of the Sephiroth, or you have...
Bless you.
thank you. Or you have the two creative faces of God, the macroprosopos and the microprosopos.
I used that joke too early.
Yes, you did. The Kabbalah... Is when I think about secret knowledge and hidden wisdom, it's like the fundamental example. It's the building block, and it is entirely the kind of stuff that I love. However, while Jewish mysticism often finds itself veiled and promising to help comprehend the great mysteries of existence, it's not all such heady stuff. You know, and while, like I said, I'd love to cover it in depth later, we're just not going to do it today. And mainly it's because it's not spooky enough. It is, after all, Spooktober. Jason, would you like to recite the traditional Spooktober poem?
You know I don't know what it is.
Gave you this option to run with it, and you did not.
What are you talking about?
There is no Spooktober poem. I thought you could make something off your head.
What? I can't rhyme.
When the colors of the leaves.
Sam,
go a changing.
Sam, we have a job to do. Sam,
and
stop.
And the voices of the ghouls start a wailing.
Don't make me leave.
There's one thing I seek. Crap. And it's Spooktober. That's the traditional Spooktober poem. And so.
Don't forget the aw crap in there.
Aw crap.
And it's Spooktober.
It's important. Yes, so secret knowledge, mysticism, that's all fascinating. We'll talk about it later, but it doesn't chill the blood like we're trying to shoot for this month. And so instead, we're going to turn to another part of the rich and varied tapestry of Jewish culture, which is their abundance of folklore. Now, there's been a few things I've wanted to cover from Jewish folklore since the beginning of the show, most prominently being the golem. Do you know what the golem is? You know what a golem is.
Yeah.
You play Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. And while we may yet find an opportunity to cover these subjects, tonight we're going to talk about something that I didn't know existed until just a few weeks ago. The D-Book.
Okay.
The D-Book.
What is the D-Book?
The D-Book.
The book?
The book.
The book.
I kind of think of it. It's spelled D-Y-B-B-U-K. I think of it as D apostrophe book. We've looked up the pronunciation a few times, and that's what it usually comes out to. So if you are a native Hebrew speaker, or not native, if you speak Hebrew, yeah, first off, we apologize. Secondly, let me know. The word dibuk, it comes from the verb devok, which means to cleave. Now, I...
Ooh. Okay.
I usually think of cleave in the term of like meat cleaver.
Right. Like, to cleave someone's head off.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Torn asunder. I don't know why I couldn't say that word, if you will. However, in this case, the word cleave actually means the exact opposite. It means to stick fast to or to cling to. This is weird. Not a mistranslation. Okay. I looked it up in the dictionary.
Cleave has an alternative meaning.
Cleave has two meanings.
I love how opposite
it is. Entirely it is opposite.
Opposite direction.
It just goes to show how crap of a language this language is. English, that is.
Amen to that.
Now, this translation of Davok to dibuk, to meaning, to cleave, to cling. This comes primarily from the behavior of the dibuk, which is a sort of a spirit that cleaves to the soul of an individual. Now, there's no direct ref...
Deep.
How?
Just wants love.
Kind of, maybe. We'll get into that.
You never know.
Here in just a moment, actually. In Hebrew, the suffix im indicates plural. So the plural of dibuk would be dibukim. And while there are no references to the dibukim in either the Kabbalah or not in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, which is the fundamental or foundational text of the Kabbalah, It's not the Kabbalah. It's just Kabbalah. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm sorry. It's
Many
this
things,
coffee.
Right?
Many things. While there people. Are no references... references to the Dibukim in Kabbalah or in the Talmud, which other than the Tanakh, which is the Hebrew Bible, is the most important document to the Jewish identity as it contains the basis of all codes of Jewish law. It's chock full of the histories and tradition of the Jewish people.
So hold on, before we get too much further.
Yes.
These scriptures, what was the time frame in which they're written?
Oh, I have no idea.
Between the Kabbalah, the Talmud.
So the Zohar, the foundational text of Kabbalah, came to light. Okay, it came to light in the 12th century.
Okay.
However,
we don't actually have like a written date.
We don't know when it started. Some people.
Well, we can carbon date that, at least for the writing of that actual text.
Well, yes, right. For that actual text, we can. But the idea is that the text of the Zohar comes to us from basically the beginning of time onwards.
Okay.
Because the
oral
secrets,
tradition.
Mm-hmm, the secrets of Kabbalah were passed from God directly to Adam, through Adam's descendants to Abraham, to Moses, through to the present day.
Okay, I didn't mean the folklore aspect of it. I meant...
Well, but that's what I'm saying is that we don't know.
Okay.
We know that its earliest account is in the 12th century.
Okay.
Now, as far as the Tanakh and the Talmud, those are foundational to the Hebrew existence itself. So you're looking anywhere, probably around, I don't know. We know exactly when the Old Testament was written. I want to say it's sometime between 1500 and 2000 BC is that area.
Right.
So some of them are very ancient. Some of them are more possibly medieval. There are people who say and claim that the Zohar was written originally in the 12th century.
And the Dibuk came around when?
The Dibuk don't actually show up until the 16th century.
Okay. Do you think that has something to do with Catholicism or Christianity in general? Like, is it, you know, that same variation? Or like we talked about with demonic jinns?
Sure. So the Dibuk, it's an interesting thing because the word, let me scroll forward here. The word doesn't find its way into literature until the 17th century AD, when Polish Jews speaking Yiddish synthesized the word. And basically it came from that time period. But as we look into the Old Testament, and even depending on your religious affiliation, parts of the New Testament, what we commonly refer to as spirit possession in the Bible is instances of a dibuk. So while they have not been named until the 17th century, this idea is as old as the religion itself.
Okay.
So
that's what I was curious about.
Is that okay? Cool.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying.
Totally.
I know I threw you off there.
No, that's okay. It came from the language of German and Polish Jews. Stories of dibuk possession started in Jewish culture, not necessarily in the actual Torah, Talmud, or anything else. They started during the Second Temple period, which is between 530 BC and 70 AD. That's when you start to get ancient writings of spirit possession outside of scripture. But when you get this appearance of this word in the 17th and late 16th, the early 17th century, as we'll see, it's sort of a resurgence for an entire genre of writing. But as far as what the dibukim actually are, like I mentioned, we think of them a lot as possession. You know, they're spirits, but that's going to mean different things to different people. And when we look at the origin of the term dibuk, we can see the exact prevailing idea on what exactly was meant. Now, the easiest answer is that the dibuk is a type of demon, but again, what's a demon? Right? In more modern thought, or not even in more modern thought, but in more Christian thought as well, you have the idea that demons are fallen angels, and they were good, and they were cast out, Lucifer and all of that, and now those are the demons. However, and it's important to say that when you die, even if you go to hell, you don't become a demon, typically, in that sort of mindset. However, this is where Kabbalah, not the Kabbalah, this is where Kabbalah comes into play. Even though the dibuk aren't actually referenced in Kabbalah and in the Zohar, what is referenced is a process called Gilgul, which is the transmigration of the soul.
Okay.
Transmigration might be my favorite word. It simply means to go from here to there.
Right.
But it's a I love that word. It just, it has weight to it. I don't know. I like words.
That's great, Sam. I like pictures.
Good. See?
They're different.
One of yours is worth 1,000 of mine. So.
Oh, man.
Boom. So Gilgul means the trans. It's a term for the transmigration of the soul. Now, Gilgul is better known in a secular term as metempsychosis, which is better known in another term.
God.
As
like Inception here.
It is.
Yeah.
That's what I find language.
Inception of language.
Language is fascinating. And especially, I don't know, especially ancient languages.
That's great. I find it annoying.
It's amazing. So metempsychosis, though, is another more scientific clinical phrase for what we would know as reincarnation. Now, this is going to right off the bat kind of caused some cognitive dissonance. It did for me. I thought Jewish people don't believe in reincarnation. And it should be stated that they don't. It's not found in the Torah. It's not found in the Tanakh, in the Talmud, any of it. But it is found in these mystical, spiritual writings of Kabbalah. Now, now, the idea of Gilgul has its earliest roots as a duality. Two different things.
Okay.
I know that we're taking a lot of time on the intro here. It's because I love this.
Oh my gosh, this is the intro.
This is the intro. We haven't even talked about what we're talking about yet.
Oh my goodness.
Like we literally.
Here we go.
Yeah, we've said dibuk, and yeah, that's like part of it. That's not even everything we're talking about. So just sit. I'm addicted to context. I love it. I need it. Gilgul is a very interesting tool. It is a duality of punishment and an act of mercy at the same time. on the part of the creator. It's a punishment because being alive is pretty much the worst thing ever. Life is hell, for sure. But it's a mercy because through this purification process, even the most unworthy souls can eventually find their way back to God. And there was debate between whether all men participate in Gi'gul or if only the wicked do. And they kind of came to the consensus that it takes at least three transmigrations of the soul, one original life, and then three transmigrations of the soul in order to get to the point where you no longer have to go through a process of rebirth or anything like that. You're just able to shoot up and out. Major Tom. However, the wicked could go through the process of transmigration thousands of times and still have thousands more to go, depending on their own worthiness and their own inherent goodness.
Is that not cruel then?
Well, that's the whole point, is that it is a punishment. It is right. It could be considered a cruel punishment, but if at the end of the day it produces a perfection or a good result.
So the ends justify the means.
Exactly. Whereas typically more modern and also more ancient religious thought is that you have one shot.
Right.
And you do it or you don't forever. And while
that's a lot of stress on you.
It is a lot of stress. And while reincarnation seems like a very long, arduous process, I mean, it's this...
What's 70 years?
Sure, times 1,000. What's 70,000 years? It's this idea of kind of like, you like Logic, I know you do. Logic, in his album Everyone, references an old, not old, but a 10, 15-year-old story.
It's everybody, but okay.
Everybody, sorry.
Yeah, you're good, you're
I
good.
I suck. References this 10, 15-year-old story that popped up on the internet called The Egg. And they almost take it word for word, yeah, where Neil deGrasse Tyson is talking and says that you're everyone. You're everybody.
Yeah, he's God.
That's where it comes from. He's God.
That's right.
And it's talking about how you have to live all of the different lives of Earth in order to become perfect enough, basically, to right. be God at the end. It's a very interesting concept. That's that kind of mysticism stuff that I love. But at the end of the day, reincarnation and the Dibuk and Gi'gul, they raise so many more questions as well and have been wrestled with by practicers of Kabbalah for the last 8 centuries at least. Questions of, well, if mankind is reincarnated, are animals reincarnated? Is there even a hell, or is the descent from life as a man to life as an animal, is that what's meant by hell and the descent into hell? You know, how does the human form relate to the animal form? Do our consciousness have any separate characteristics, or does it simply matter into the container in which our souls are poured? And these are questions that aren't only addressed in Kabbalah, but in Eastern Hinduism and everything with the wheel of reincarnation, Buddhism, and all of that. And those are questions that we're not going to talk about because we don't know, but they're good questions. Ask those questions. And keep in mind that as we talk about these topics that we are only ever so slightly versed in, we're exploring just one side of all of this. So again, if you know more than us, let us know. We always like to be corrected. We typically prefer for it to happen once and not 36 times. But if it has to come from 36 different people, as it did a few months ago, I can't remember for what now, feel free. Oh, it's when I called Mary Queen of Scots Bloody Mary. Yeah, we had like 30 people write in, and I love you all for it.
Well, I'm pretty sure they all didn't reference each other.
No, they didn't. It's not like everybody got together and was like, let's yell at Sam. Now, however we end up thinking about it, for those who accept the idea of Gi'gul, the Dibukim, these evil, unclean spirits, were human spirits. Okay, and that's another big difference between traditional possession, the jinn, which before we started recording, Jason said, how is this not just the jinn again? Well, it kind of is, but it's kind of not.
So it's Supernatural's version of demons.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah, it's this idea that these people have been so wicked that they cannot be allowed to even transmigrate. They cannot be reborn. They can't go to heaven. They can't go to hell. They have to wander.
You are what you are.
They have to wander. And when they wander, they're referred to as the Dibuk or the Dibukim, known as Denuded Spirits, which is a great band name. And they finally seek a refuge in the bodies of whatever living things they can find. One popular story regarding Dibukim that will be recognizable to a good amount of our listeners, especially because we've referenced it before in the show, is that of Legion, right? This idea of this devil that was in a person and then they were cast out and then they went into the body of pigs. This is a intelligent being that simply wants to exist and have a body somehow. And so it takes a human first, but if it can't get it, it drowns 2,000 pigs in the water and then everybody gets upset about it. But
yeah, that's a lot of bacon.
It's a lot of bacon, especially back in...
I can't eat that much bacon.
32 AD, that's...
I can try everything I can, but I just can't.
Yeah. He's tried. He can do 300 pigs. One sit.
Easy.
That's child's play. 2,000, that's a little bit much.
Gotta bring over the whole family.
And what the stories of Gilgul, of the Dibukim, of Legion and all of this betray, we'll say, is another aspect of Kabbalah, which is Ibur.
You're just having one heck of a time.
I'm loving this.
I'm happy for you.
Sometimes I feel bad about giving...
No, you're having a blast.
I'm loving this.
I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to listen.
Okay, we're going to get to the story in a minute, I promise.
That's fine. It doesn't matter to me.
Now, Ibur is the great, it was regarded as one of the great secrets of the Kabbalah. One of the I'm just going to keep saying the Kabbalah and we'll go from there.
Because you keep screwing
I
up.
Just keep doing it.
Well, the problem is in your notes, you have it the Kabbalah.
Yeah.
You fool.
Maybe that is the right way. I don't think it is, though. But in any case, Ibur was this great...
Well, is the Kabbalah a thing, or is it
No,
a...
it would essentially be saying the Judaism, or
yeah,
the
exactly.
Christianity.
That's what I'm saying.
So it's not great.
Good job.
Thank you. So Ibur translates to impregnation.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. Alrighty.
It's this idea...
That escalated quickly.
That a person may be temporarily entered into by an additional soul. Now, this can be a positive experience, wherein the souls of the righteous transmigrating on their way to paradise may enter the body of someone who is striving and attempting to do good, to give them strength and to give them the power to complete the good that they want to do. Or, alternatively, if such a righteous man has fulfilled almost all of the 613 mitzvot, or commandments of ritual obedience to the will of God, then he may be given the opportunity to temporarily live in the body of one with the capability to fulfill these final mitzvot, thereby bypassing the need to live an entire another life just to complete one or two tasks, to avoid being denied entrance into paradise altogether. Elsewise, these positive entities, sometimes known as the Magidim, or singular Magid, may manifest as a voice coming out of the mystic of one, or the coming out of the mouth of one mystic to another in order to impart the secrets of Kabbalah. However, while Ibur can occur with the righteous, it can also occur with the unrighteous, creating that Dibuk. Unlike the righteous, who enter the body and soul of another person to achieve a specific purpose at a specific time, the entering itself is the purpose to be achieved, and once it has been achieved, it is not easily given up. As in every culture that has a belief in negative possessing entities, exorcism rites have sprung up in order to combat these harmful beings, and these rites are still in practice to this day. Now, the rituals are not standardized, unlike the exorcism rites of the Catholic Church and other such organizations with handbooks on these sorts of things, but often the invocation of higher beings, angels specifically, will be utilized, and the power of God is used in order to remove the being of the Dibuk through the power of prayer. However, with all things in the unknown and the folkloric, there is always variance. And more modern, recent exorcisms of the Dybbuk seem to take on more ritual components. Take, for example, an exorcism which took place in Brazil of 2010, a video which found its way online and shows a group of men surrounding a single man who is believed to be inhabited by a Dybbuk. Now, this man is wearing a mask. It's like a tannish bag that has eyes cut for the holes in the nose, but nothing for the mouth. However, even though there's no hole for the mouth, you can still hear the man screaming in a guttural, very deep guttural voice. And all of the men gather around and yell the same exact phrase, which is Dybbuk tez. I'm sorry, guys, I'm messing up. Dybbuk tez tez, which means out Dybbuk, out. Now, however, despite these powerful rites, which included 4 hours of prayer and the blowing of the ceremonial shofar horn, the Dybbuk remained in this Brazilian man. Now, other exorcisms, especially, like I said, this became, in the 16th and 17th century, it became its own genre. You had genres of Dybbuk literal. Or literature of possession stories and exorcism stories. And this is where a lot of the lore itself comes from, because these stories appeal to the more human intelligence of the Dybbuk itself. Very akin to our quasi-secular understanding of demon possession. We don't think of them as unthinking creatures. They're very intelligent beings. And back in the 17th centuries, these stories sold printing into pamphlet or These stories sold, printed into pamphlets, and creating a genuine air of belief and excitement. What's really interesting is that you have, so this again happened in like the Poland area,
mm-hmm.
is where these stories in the modern day really came out. And Judaism has different, it's in different areas of the world, especially before World War II, it spread all over the place. And like some of the more southern, like the Lithuanian Jews, the more refined, you know, you would think of, you know, French and English and these quote unquote more refined places or whatever. They looked on a lot of the beliefs of those further removed members of Judaism, and they thought they were uncivilized or supernatural or
heretics?
No, not heretics.
Like gypsies?
No.
Like
that's a slur.
I apologize, but
the proper term is Romani. No, they thought of them as simple. The same way that you think of me when I talk about like the Wolfmen, like being real.
What do you mean?
Superstitious.
Ah,
there we go. There we go. Simple, superstitious. I'm sure Jason is gonna pop in with another word if I can think of one. Anyway,
unorthodox.
There we go. And so they did. They thought of their neighbors in Poland in the area as superstitious and credulous people. However, these stories made their way throughout all of the different regions of Europe, and even the more quote unquote skeptical members of the Judaic community, of the Hebrew community, they believed in this. It was a genuine concern and fear, and still is in some areas. Now, it was said, though, that the first and most important step that one must take in order to properly exorcise a Dybbuk is to learn its name, either by trickery or else simply by listening, because the Dybbuk, they often find great joy in telling their life stories and, due to the mindset that these beings often have, lamenting the injustices of God and people against them.
Wait, are we sure this just isn't my uncle?
I'm not sure, actually. I've never met your uncle. He could be possessed by a Dybbuk, but they make excuses. They talk about how unfairly they've been treated. However, in the telling of the story, the Dybbuk accidentally reveal their name. And at that point, it's practically game over, because much like in the popular novel series that I still have not read and may never read, despite everyone telling me to, which is The Kingkiller Chronicle, I await your letters.
Has there been a adaptation for that?
They're making one. Like I think it's a TV show that they're making. Lin-Manuel Miranda's working on the music. That'll be good.
Nice. Because that sounds familiar. Like, I'm trying to think of...
The Name of the Wind? That's the first book.
No. The concept of knowing a demon's name gives you power over it. Like, that...
Yeah, I don't know with
feels
demons...
Feels like it's been explored before.
Demons...
And I just can't put my finger on it.
Demons specifically may be in, like, Supernatural. I don't know. Or something else. But it is. That's the concept, is that if you know something's name, in the Name of the Wind, it's like literally, if you know the true name of stone, you can bend it to your will. I don't know what that means because I've never read these books, but everyone says they're great. Because I've read the first 15 pages about 45 times. I don't know. It's like an 800-page book. That's too much.
Just get an audiobook.
I don't do audiobooks.
Why not? I do podcasts. What's the difference?
Yeah.
They're very similar.
I don't have to pay for podcasts.
That's fair.
But yeah, if you know the name of something, you can command it. And it's the same thing in this case. If you know the name of the book, you take them out. However, you don't do it automatically. Because the exorcist will typically wait until the end of the story in any case, because learning more about the disembodied soul may help to assist the practitioner in their final task, which is answering the question of what to do with the spirit once it has been removed. As far as removal goes, there are again many different ways of doing this. However, in some of the more popular cases, it includes the lighting of a white candle and the opening of an empty flask. Once the name is revealed, the practitioner calls it out and then calls that dibuk out of the person into the flask and seals it, at which point the flask will glow red.
Ooh. Were you able to find one of those on eBay?
No.
Don't worry.
I didn't look. You probably could, though. But once you have it out, there's the question of what to do with it. Either A, the dibuk remains in the flask or whatever other vessel it is in. It doesn't have to be a flask. B, it is absolved of enough of its sin through rites and rituals performed to allow it to either transmigrate into another body, its own body, or descend into hell. Or C, it is completely absolved and allowed to enter paradise. B is the most common resolution. C is the second most common resolution. But what would happen?
I kind of like the idea of the transformer solution to Megatron. Just throw it into the trench.
What?
Just throw it into the Mariana Trench. Just get rid of it.
Wow, is that what they do to Megatron?
Yeah.
That's cold.
Didn't last.
Yeah, oh, no. Take the flask.
Unfortunately,
and throw
a second movie was made.
That's not, like, if you throw something in the Mariana's Trench...
Eventually the pressure will break it open.
It's going to break it.
But the concept is what I'm getting at.
Okay.
The concept.
Yeah, sure. So don't throw it in the Mariana's Trench.
But, you know, get rid of it.
Get rid of it. Yeah, bury it or something. What you shouldn't do is keep it in your home for a number of years, warning your grandchildren to never touch it, to never look at it, to never think about it. And it definitely should not be sold at an estate sale after you die at the age of 103 years old.
That's extremely specific. Oh, there's a reason to that. Well, it's kind of like I keep playing around with the idea of buying a tarantula. Because tarantulas and other spiders give off pheromones that drive away other spiders. So, maybe...
We have to join them to beat them.
Exactly. But if I only have one spider, I know where that spider's at.
Until you don't. That's always my fear.
I know
with
where the
tarantulas.
D-book's at.
That's true.
You know? I can keep an eye on it that way.
That's true.
I'm a watcher.
You're just going to sit there all day looking at your tarantula to make sure it doesn't escape.
Right there. Brought
Man.
It with me.
I still, every day, look on the ceiling where I saw the biggest spider I'd ever seen in my life, and I still fear it every day.
Tim, we got to get you out more, man. Take you camping or something where you actually have to, like, deal with things.
They're coming for me.
Okay.
Now you're right, Jason. About everything you just said, but you're especially right.
About getting you out of the house?
That you're wrong about. You're right on what you said about what I said being oddly specific.
Oh, okay. Really backing up there.
Yeah.
Perfect. It's like I've read the notes or something.
Now, the reason I was so oddly specific is because we enter here our story. At the exact moment that a rather peculiar wooden box, that's right, it only took us 40 minutes to get here. So, again, all of that last 40 minutes was to say that the main difference between a demon and a Dubuque is that a Dubuque is a human intelligence and a demon is typically not. But I wanted to really...
But you can also put them in things like you can djinns.
You can. And that's the other thing is that typically, I mean, you do have like this idea of like possessed dolls and stuff, which is terrible. But like you don't really see that.
Is it weird that that scares me more than a possessed person?
Oh, no.
Okay.
That's
good,
totally
good.
Normal.
Okay.
I keep toying around with the idea of doing like possessed dolls as an episode, but I just don't want to go through that.
I'm good.
I don't want to experience that.
I don't need
that.
To know. I just don't.
No.
I'll watch Annabelle again. I'll be fine.
Yeah. I don't want that.
That's enough.
See, it's a interesting synthesis because you don't usually have like, oh, my demon is possessing this tree or this lamp or whatever, which djinn do. Like djinn right. possess anything and everything. Whereas the Dubuque is an interesting synthesis of the two of them. Now, our story, though, it begins at the exact moment that a rather peculiar wooden box was acquired by an Oregonian antique collector. And by the way, it's pronounced Oregon, not Oregon. Oregonian antiques collector named Kevin.
Who says Oregon?
I was just listening to a podcast. I think it was on my brother and me, where they said Oregon.
What?
Yeah.
Not a polygon.
No.
It's Oregon.
It's Oregon. Or, again, Oregon.
Anyway.
Where'd you leave the Oregon? It's over there by the boat. That's how you can remember. There's a fun little memory trick for you.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
So good. That's great. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. This antiques collector named Kevin Manis in September of 2001, which is pretty much right after I moved from Kaiser, Oregon to Boise, Idaho. Thank God. Because now I don't have to be in the same state as this thing. This box, this peculiar box, whose measurements are 12.5 inches by 7.5 inches by 16.25 inches.
Is it 16.25 tall or deep? Deep?
Tall.
Is it 12 inches tall? Is it 12 inches deep? Wide? Wide? Is it 12 inches wide, 16 inches
There's
tall?
There's like a standard form for this, isn't there?
It sounds a lot like a jewelry box.
It's mm-hmm. a little over a foot tall.
Okay.
It would seem. Seven. So what is the 7 inches? The 7 inches are...
Maybe be depth. Yeah.
Depth. So height, depth, width, across. Yeah. Ah. I think that it's 16 inches tall
okay.
and 12 inches across and 7 inches deep.
Okay.
That's what I assume. If not...
That's probably like the standard size for like I said, a jewelry box.
Yeah, it's not
somewhere
a...
Somewhere around that.
Yeah.
Physical size. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I just did it with my hands.
Yeah.
So, now, the wood is a dark brown wood. It has two doors that open outward. I clicked away. It has two doors that open outward. It has a little drawer underneath. And on either door is a metal relief of a bunch of grapes. Because this was a wine cabinet, or it was supposed to be a wine cabinet. Kevin found this box at an estate sale in Portland following the passing of a 103-year-old woman named Havila. Now, Kevin did not know the woman nor any of her family, but while he was there, he met the granddaughter of the deceased. He opted to not include any additional names into the descriptions of his events from here, so we simply know her as Havila's granddaughter. And from her, we learn also, by the way, this story is like, I want you all to listen to this story and at home to count along with me all the red flags. Okay? All right.
One red flag.
He learned from Havila's granddaughter that her grandmother had been a Polish Jew and a Holocaust survivor to boot, the only one of her family to survive the concentration camp that she had been put into. Now, the only way she had been able to do this was by way of an escape, which was made with a few other prisoners, and remarkably, they made their way all the way to Spain, where she remained until after the war was over. After that, she made her way to the United States. Now, she came to the States with just three possessions. She had a steamer trunk, which I assume was full of clothing, but it doesn't even say that. It just says a trunk.
Okay.
A sewing box and a small wine cabinet, big enough for
gotta get lit.
Woof.
I don't know, man.
Big enough for just a few bottles.
Okay. Cool.
The wine cabinet was the most important of the possessions to Havilah. At least it would seem that way. Now, while the granddaughter didn't know where the cabinet came from, other than she seemed to have picked it up while she was living in Spain, she did know that her grandmother spent a lot of time with this box. In fact, when she saw Kevin holding the box, she said, "Ah, you've picked up the Dybbuk box." Dybbuk box. And Kevin says, What's a Dybbuk? And she says, "I don't know." Which is an important thing to remember, that while this was all the craze in 17th century Poland, it's not a super, or at least it hasn't been a super well-known concept, even within members of the Jewish community, since then, into the modern day. So he says, "What's a Dybbuk and what's a Dybbuk box?" And she says, "I don't know. That's just what my grandmother called it." My grandmother, whenever we asked her what was in the box, she would say, "A Dybbuk Kesselim." Now, the granddaughter, like I said, doesn't know what a Dybbuk is, and nobody knows what the word Kesselim means. It's still a mystery to this day.
Maybe it's its name.
It could be, and that is a theory, to be sure.
Has that never been brought up before?
I don't know.
Okay.
Probably. Maybe not. You cracked it, Chase.
We know it. It's not Robert Paulson.
I'm so proud of you.
Well, I mean, if we don't know what the word actually, it's like my last name. It's not an actual like Portuguese word or anything. It's just a name.
It's just Moitoso.
Yeah.
Exactly. Doesn't mean anything. That's fair.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, so it could be the name. I'm fine with that. It is not a Hebrew nor Yiddish word, and the only language to which it has been translated correctly...
Kesselim sounds like a name, too.
It kind of does. It's like that rat Kesselim.
Why'd you name a rat Kesselim?
He's a rat of a person because he's possessing my box. Mm.
Hey, I'm sure he doesn't want to be in the box.
I want to live. I want to live. What's that from? I can't remember. Anyway, so yes, not a Hebrew word, not a Yiddish word. The only...
Pinocchio?
The only translation is found in Turkish, which so far, as everyone knew, Havilah did not speak. And in Turkish, Kesselim means let us cut.
Ah, shoot.
Let us cut. So I'd like you to take your red flag counter and mark it to 2. One for the fact that...
I've got like 12.
The old woman would spit in her hands 3 times and then say, "A Dybbuk Kesselim." And then second, for Kesselim means let us cut. At this point, though, none of the red flags were raised on Manus's side.
Are we sure it's not just like a demon cutter?
The box?
Yeah.
You throw it at demons. It cuts them in half. Demon cutting box.
I don't know what's on the inside of that thing.
We will find out.
Oh, of course we will.
It'd be like a
saw box.
It is understandable. Manus had no way of knowing what the word Dybbuk meant. And even if you knew what it meant, in 2001, the idea of something being a haunted box is not the most credible thing on the block.
Because it is now.
The only ominous thing of it, though, that Havilah's granddaughter did tell Kevin is that Havilah always kept the box high, out of the reach of young children. And when the young children grew, upon asking how to open or asking about the box, Havilah would force them to swear an oath that they would never, ever, ever open the box.
That's where grandma keeps her good wine.
There you go. That is red flag number 3 for those of you playing along at home.
Are you sure you're just not like reading the script to a movie or something?
This has been made into a movie. Did you see The Possession? It was in 2012.
No.
I didn't see it. The poster and like trailer of it shows like a child like with some sort of substance vomiting upwards into the sky. Yeah,
you can stop.
It's terrible. So that's number three. Red flag number four is that Havilah told her grandchildren to make sure the box was buried with her. But because of Jewish Orthodox burial customs, this was simply impossible. So Kevin then asked the granddaughter.
Howard made the exception.
Kevin asked the granddaughter and said, well, do you want to open the box? I'm buying the box. I'm going to open the box. Do you finally want to see what's inside? And she was like, nope. She emphatically declined. Now, after picking up a few more.
She knew what was in the box. She knew it.
It's Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Again?
We had to.
She keeps growing those things.
They keep finding their ways in the box.
She's a hydra.
I'd watch that movie.
Oh, dear.
So Kevin then goes forward. He buys a few more things. He buys, like, the sewing kit or the sewing box that Havilah brought over as well.
I mean, he's already two for three. Where's the trunk?
Yeah, pretty much. The trunk, I don't know if he could find or if it was gone or, but before he leaves, he's already paid. And on his way out, he chats up again with the granddaughter. And he says, you know, I really feel uncomfortable about this box. And at this point, I assume the granddaughter started to sweat a little. And he said, because it seems like a precious family heirloom. Not because it seems haunted, because it seems like something that's important to your family. You're telling me that this was one of three things your grandmother brought to America.
Well, he was fine with buying the sewing kit.
Well, but the sewing kit didn't stay up and out of the reach of children. While it could be possibly haunted, it could also just mean that it was very precious and that the grandmother didn't want it hurt or destroyed. Okay. And the idea that bury it with me. This was obviously a very important thing to Havilah. And he says he's just not comfortable buying it because it's so important. It shouldn't go to a stranger. This I can really identify with because right now in my closet are my grandfather's dress blues from the military, which I took when they were preparing an estate sale of his and my grandmother's things. And I took them simply because I didn't want to think of like a stranger taking them. I was like, I have no point to owning these. It just feels wrong. I also have a really cool hat.
Okay.
I'll show you later.
I can't wait.
But I can understand that sentiment. But when confronted with this, Havilah's granddaughter had no such sentiment. In fact, he offers the box back. And the woman says, no, I can't take that. You already paid for it. You purchased it.
Yeah. No take back.
It pretty much devolves into that. You purchased this. This is yours. And he says, no. You know what? Keep the money as an act of kindness in this trying time. Just have the box. I don't want you to be parted from this precious family possession. And at this point, this pretty much is. She essentially says, no, you made a deal. She says, you made a deal. That's red flag number five. She says, you cannot take it back. And she actually starts to cry and tells him he has to leave. She's not taking the box. It's his box now. In hindsight, Kevin dismisses red flag number five by saying, well, she was grieving. People are weird when they're in grief. And that's true. People do very strange things when they're in grief.
Sam, let's focus up here. Stop looking and daydreaming. You got this.
In any case, he takes his cool new box back to his furniture refinishing store that he owns. He owns a shop.
I'm going to polish that bad boy up.
Exactly. Because he wants to give it to his mother for her birthday, which
that
is
lovely.
At the end of October, the next month. For those of you playing alone at home.
Interesting. October, you say.
For those of you playing alone at home, your Dybbuk card box or your Dybbuk box card should still be flipped to sealed. Because somehow or another, Kevin does not open the box. He takes it and he puts it in the shop. And then he's like, oh, wait, I have things to do. And so this box that has stayed closed for at least 70 years, apparently it's not enticing enough for him to call it because he goes out and he runs out to do errands.
Mm-hmm. Now, sure. Likely story.
He makes it about 30 minutes into his errands. And as he's jaunting around town, the first in a very long line of very, very strange things to happen happened. A call comes through on his cell phone from his salesperson at the shop. She had heard someone breaking glass in the workshop, which, as far as I understand, you have like a sales floor or a show floor, and then the workshop was a subterranean basement area, and that is where he put the box. He hears glass breaking. He hears people yelling. He hears swear words, curse words being screamed. She tries to leave the building through the front door. But somehow the exits have all been inexplicably locked.
Was it speaking English?
She just said it was cursing. It was yelling curse words, swear words. So I'd assume so.
Okay.
Yeah. The building is locked, even though it only locks... I mean, yes, technically it locks from the inside, but it was locked from the outside. Yeah. The ghost used HomeKit.
Man, that's smart.
That's like the new Christmas commercial.
That's real smart. So easy a ghost can do it.
There we go. That's bad. She, for her part of it, has barricaded herself in the office area. And Kevin says, okay, call the police. I'm coming home. And then his cell phone battery dies. Now this is 2001. Batteries died all the time back then. They had memories. It was weird. Lithium ion. I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say Nokia. Nokia batteries lasted forever, but I mean, the rest of them were probably crap.
Yeah, they're still going.
Yeah, they're still going. Now, as he returns to the shop, he does find it's got gates over it. Like those shutter gates. So those have been
metal
closed and locked.
Perfect.
From the outside.
Well,
which is something
you don't lock them from the inside.
Something only someone with a key should be able to do.
Would make sense.
Like Kevin. Or like his associate. But his associate, as he finds after unlocking the door, is still barricaded in the office crying. He says, it's okay, we're here now. And I'm assuming he grabs a bat or something, and he goes down into the workshop, which is completely black, pitch black, but he doesn't hear anything. So he grabs a flashlight and he turns it on, and he sees that there are 19 different light bulbs, each one of them that has been shattered. And there is no sign of an intruder.
He has some weird power surge, eh?
It could be a power surge that knew curse words. It's the most powerful surge of all. He also found that there was an overwhelming smell of cat urine mixed with something that he would later be able to identify as jasmine. Now there was...
That is interesting.
Yes, it's an interesting combination, is it not? Now there was no other exit for anyone to go through other than the one that was still locked when he arrived. Nobody would have been able to brush past him without him knowing it. And when he went upstairs, his salesperson had left and would never return. He called her multiple times. She told him, I don't work there anymore. And she wouldn't talk anymore about what she heard. The only time they talked about it was in the moment on the phone when she said somebody's screaming.
Well, she got possessed from there.
Probably.
Oh, man. I was just shot in the
bum,
dark.
Bum, 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 bum.
I'm out of here. So long.
Farewell. Now, he paid... No, Jason, no. Come back.
I know what those words mean.
It's Pavlovian at this point. He paid no mind, though, to the box that was sitting in the workshop area.
Yeah, and like the doors, it wasn't opened.
No.
Nothing got released.
Why
is this happening? I don't get it.
He would pay no
mind.
This
isn't how it works. This is bad storytelling.
This is not consistent with my mythological paranormal view of the universe. He would pay no mind to the box as he swept up the glass, replacing the bulbs, and went about hiring a new employee, and in fact, the box wouldn't enter his mind at all for about 2 weeks. But with his mother's birthday fast approaching, he decided now was the time to get to work on spiffying up that spooky box. The first thing he noticed in regards to the box, however, was that what he refers to as a quote-unquote unique little mechanism. When one of the doors of the box was opened, the mechanism causes the other door and a small drawer to open all at the same time, as if by magic.
That's cool.
And I say that because there were no hardware components to make this happen. There were no springs. There was no connection that he could see. But without fail, when he opened one of the doors, everything opened. Now, Again, if you're playing along at home, you can go ahead and flip your Dybbuk box card to unsealed, because...
Why do we have cards? I'm confused. It flips?
It flips. One side says sealed. I should have told people to make this before we start the episode.
I'm so confused. I don't even have one.
I know. I'll make a post on Facebook about it.
Okay.
I'm going to do it. One side should say sealed. The other says unsealed. And then if you want to find like a little G.I. Joe character that once you flip it to unsealed, you can start just pulling apart into pieces, that would be good too.
What? Okay, now, who is strong enough to pull apart a G.I. Joe character? Like a little, I'm thinking of an army.
Who has that power? A Dybbuk. That's who. Now, inside the box, he found an assortment of curious trinkets. He found two U.S. wheat pennies, one from 1928 and one from 1925. He found two small locks of hair bound with string, one blonde and one brown. He found a small granite block with the Hebrew letters of Shalom carved into it. He found a golden wine cup, a dried rosebud, and a cast iron candlestick holder with octopus legs as supports.
All that's weird. That is the weirdest box. That's the weirdest junk drawer I've ever heard.
Thank you. It is quite strange, is it not?
That is a weird, weird combination of things. It's now, like I'm trying to piece together like a
why or how. What I find is interesting is
a
that
riddle.
you have for a lot of things you have, or for some of the things you have two of them. You have two pennies and you have two cuts of hair, and we're going to talk more about that in the second episode as to why that possibly was.
Thank God.
But it belays like a ritual sort of thing.
Doesn't remind me of voodoo at all.
Yeah,
nothing.
It seems a little weird, doesn't it? Now, he also found, though, on the back of the box, an inscription that was carved in Hebrew. Others examining the box after Kevin have found that this was a carving of the Shema prayer. Now, the Shema prayer is the centerpiece of morning and evening Jewish prayer services, which speaks to the monotheistic essence of the Judaic religion, which set it apart in times of old. The translation of the Shema prayer states, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." This is totally not something that would be used to bind a vengeful spirit, right? Wrong. Maybe. Who knows? It's probably haunted.
Probably not.
Again, I would say that our red flag counter is up to 9 at this point, based on my count. And every single one of them, he just ignores. But he finally decides... He finally decides not to... And the other thing about it, all of the contents of the box, he goes back to Havilah's and gets in contact. He must get in contact with like the estate sales company who got in contact with him, because he said, here's these things, like this, there's hair here, there's like memorabilia and this holy, potentially holy object, like here. And they were like, no, no take backs. We don't want them. So
it's like Storage Wars. It's all yours.
Haunted box wars.
Yeah,
you bid on haunted boxes.
I'm down.
I'd be not down to do that. Maybe at your house, I would do that.
Cool.
That'd be good. Now, here's the thing. Like we said, the box has been unsealed. And something has to happen when the box is unsealed. It has to.
I imagine like a big rush of air.
I would think so.
You know?
There was no rush of air,
darn,
as far as we know. But
darn,
what
smells?
Did? Well, I can't remember if he talked about potentially the inside of the box also smelling like cat piss, because that's like a reoccurring theme throughout all of this.
Perfect. Maybe he just had a stray.
It could be. What does happen, though, is he opens the box and nothing happens until that evening. Now, starting from the night that he opens the box onward, and I'm going to count this as about 7 red flags in one, so we're up to 16.
He's still so arbitrary now, man. What are you? Okay.
He's still. Right. This is probably the biggest red flag. Therefore, it cannot count as just one red flag.
So he's oblivious to everything, is what you're telling me.
He still does not make any connection to the box. Although the day that he opens it, he starts to have a horrible reoccurring nightmare. He not only has it every single night, but anytime he closes his eyes for more than a few minutes, it almost starts to play. Now, essentially, it is him and a loved one, either a family member, a friend, someone close to him.
Okay.
They're walking and they're talking. And he doesn't really remember what they're talking about. But what he does remember, with that kind of weird crispness you can get in the essence of a dream that you carry over to the next day, is almost a camera shot focused only on the eyes of the other person. Imagine a movie, close up of the eyes of the other person.
And I'm imagining slowly, Sam.
I'm making a box around my face right now for
it's
Jason.
Really,
imagine
something, it's something special. That's the frame. I got it, Sam. Where's the bottom of the frame?
And as he's focusing on these eyes, something changes. The eyes don't physically change, but they do. And as the shot then pulls out of the eyes, he realizes that he's no longer looking into the eyes of a loved one or a friend. He's looking into the eyes of a monster, something he describes as a gruesome, terrible, demonic hag, the most frightening thing he had ever seen standing right in front of him. And then in his own words, in the dream, the hag would proceed to beat the living tar out of him. In the morning, he would wake, and he would find strange bruises upon his body. And this is why I think it counts for 7 red flags in 1. But he still doesn't think anything to do about the box. However, he does decide not to refinish it completely. He thinks that just giving it a good scrubbing will be enough to get it up to snuff. He doesn't want to take away from the character. No, he just doesn't want to take away from the character of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens for weeks, night after night after night, until his mother's birthday.
Box to mom. Good old mom.
Now, his mother's birthday was the 28th of October, but because she was out of town, they were unable to meet up until the 31st of October.
All right.
All Hallows Eve.
Sam, when did you make up the story?
The spookiest night of the year. I didn't make this up.
I don't believe you.
I didn't make any of this up. I'll post my sources.
It's a good thing this got turned into a movie, because
it's perfect.
It's so ridiculous.
Now, on that afternoon, not evening, that afternoon, Kevin meets up with his mom at the shop, planning on heading out for lunch, but wanting to give her the cabinet first so that she can just have to haul it around town.
Apparently. Throw it in the car.
Now,
but don't forget,
I wouldn't trust Portland with a nice cabinet.
Here you go, Mom.
They'll break into your car.
In the trunk?
In the trunk. They love it.
Okay.
What? They love theft over there in Portland. Yeah, bunch of thieves.
All right.
I don't know. After we're done alienating our listeners. Now, he gives her the cabinet. Hey, Mom, look, it's a wine cabinet. Nothing of the 17 red flags. And then says, okay, Mom, I gotta go. I think we're at 16 red flags. That's right. Thanks for reminding me, Jace. And says, okay, now I gotta make a business call. Bye, Mom. And he goes out. He just seems stupid from this point onwards. Almost unbelievably so. He goes and makes a phone call. A businessy business call. And he's on the phone for 5 minutes. That's a long time to be on a phone call. But
I have 40-minute conversations with my mother all the time.
Well, that's good, but he's not talking to his mom. He's talking to, like, a business person.
Okay.
So,
let's pretend like 5 minutes is a long time.
I feel like it's a long time. My phone calls are all under a minute, unless I'm, like, calling my wife.
What's your age?
What is my age? What's my age again? What's my age again? Spooky, spooky, spooky. That is also the traditional Spooktober hymn. Thank you. 5 minutes later, one of his employees comes running into his office and says something's wrong. And he says, sorry, Bob, gotta go. And he hangs up the phone and he goes. And his mother is sitting there, sitting at the table where he had left her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have any expression on her face at all. But she has tears streaming down her face.
She really likes the box.
Now, she couldn't speak, and it became clear after a few minutes that she couldn't move. And so Kevin called an ambulance, and they took her to the hospital. Now, what's interesting is that Kevin does have and has provided documentation to show that his mother was admitted to the hospital on October 31st in the year of our Lord, 2001 AD.
Okay.
He also has the documentation that says that she suffered a stroke, because she did.
Okay.
Which is why she couldn't move, but why she was still crying and this and that. Now, the next day, they say, we got to keep her overnight. She can't move. She's partially paralyzed. She couldn't understand, or she could understand things being said to her, but she could not speak. And instead, she used her extremely limited mobility to point out letters on a chart. The next day, November 1st, Kevin visits her and asks her how she's feeling today. And she points out on the chart, like a Ouija board.
Perfect.
And it says,
where's that planchette?
It says N-O-G-I-F-T.
She forgot the space. She forgot the space.
You point, and then you point away, and then you point back.
Nogift.
Nogift. Or, if you're a normal person, no gift. Now, betraying some sort of an underlying fault in his psychological makeup, Kevin instantly gets defensive and tells his mom that even if she doesn't remember, he did get her a gift. He got her a gift, and she can't say that she didn't get him a gift.
Kevin forgot.
Kevin has
some other year.
Some issues, for sure. And then my favorite thing to happen in this entire...
He's that defensive. He's forgotten in the past.
Yeah. Which would make him defensive.
And he's never lived it down.
No. My favorite thing to happen in this entire saga so far, in part one of this saga, happens now, wherein after he defends himself, his mother spells again. H-A-T-E-G-I-F-T.
Had a gift?
Hate.
Oh.
Gift.
No. Oh. I was hoping there was a hat involved.
So if Kevin does have some sort of underlying psychological problem regarding giving gifts to his mother on her birthday, I guarantee this is going to make it worse when she literally takes the time to spell out hate gift as opposed to no like gift.
That's cold.
Gift not for me. Not my favorite. No. Hate gift. And at this point, this is where I say he's just being an idiot. He laughs. He says, oh, mom, you're being so funny. I'll tell you what, you get better soon and I'll get you any gift you want. And then he goes along his merry way. That's going to be 13 more red flags, taking us up to 29, one for each letter. Now, eventually, Kevin's mother was able to speak. She did recover. But they never spoke of this incident. Later on that day, he learned that his lease had not been renewed.
There's 14 letters. I counted twice.
How many did I say?
13.
13?
You're close.
I guessed. I was just approximating.
How could you?
So what? That takes us up to a nice round 30 red flags.
Where are we putting all these flags?
Wherever you want. In the box.
Are we designing a racetrack?
Yes.
Are we just poking them up? Okay, perfect. Lovely.
So he finds out that his lease hasn't been renewed. He's unable to find out why. He's been good for it. He's paid his bills. It should have been a no problem sort of a thing, but apparently it was a problem.
Yeah.
He could just be a deadbeat. But we have to take all of this from his perspective. Now, mom hate gift cabinet. So he gives cabinet to sister. Sister keeps cabinet for a week, then gives it back, claiming, here's an interesting one. She couldn't get the doors to stay closed.
Oh, they're unbalanced.
They kept opening themselves up. And this is very interesting because Kevin, in his description of this event, says to his sister, "Sister, you're so stupid. There's no springs that could cause the doors to open." Where he himself had just moments before been like this beautiful, curious, invisible mechanism that causes everything to open up at the same time. But in any case, not only could it not stay closed, it also smelled like cat pee and jasmine. Again.
I think he's just a schmuck.
Then he gave it to his brother, who also complained of the smell of cat pee and jasmine. And you do get this idea that maybe Kevin just isn't the most cleanly person. He does claim that he doesn't have a cat, but there could be other explanations for that smell. He then gives it to his girlfriend, who he doesn't mention up till this entire point.
Now, hold on. Your mom doesn't like it. Your sister doesn't like it. Your brother hates it. So these are all people that are your family. People that can't just cast you aside. So then the next logical person you give it to is someone that you care about.
You give
that can
you have
leave
had,
you.
You have had four people tell you that this box smells like old cat pee and it doesn't work.
Quite possibly the people that love you the most.
And so you decide to give it to your girlfriend. Kevin, you're a jerk.
Kevin, if you wanted to get out of the relationship,
you didn't have to pee on a box.
You didn't
man.
Have to pee on a box. You didn't have to give it to him. Just be honest. It's really what it comes down to. Express your feelings.
Honesty is always the best policy. Peeing on a box is always the worst policy. There is no Venn diagram here.
There you go. PSA
they are
announcement right there.
Mutually exclusive. After 2 days, the girlfriend says the box makes her feel weird and that he should just get rid of it already. And he says,
that's
all
a nice
right,
way
all
of putting
right.
it.
I know, right? He says, okay, I'll get rid of it. So he sells it to a couple of middle-aged antique collectors. 3 days later, no announcement, nothing. It just shows back up on his doorstep with a note that says, this has a bad darkness.
I mean, okay.
He tries to get a hold of the couple. They will not answer or return his calls.
Man, caller ID was lit back in 2001.
Caller ID, piss cabinet. piss cabinet guy. That was Kevin in their phone. The cabinet from there stayed with him. Now, a few weeks later, he had his siblings over to his place, they ended up staying the evening. The next morning, over breakfast, his sister told him about a terrible nightmare she had had the previous evening, and it was the exact one that he continually had had every night since the box was in his home, but once the box had left his home, he puts this all together. You know that meme of the blonde lady, and it's got like all of the different mathematical signs and things,
yes.
And she's like putting it all together? That's Kevin right now.
One of those slightly confused looks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Kevin right now. And he's putting it all together.
Have I seen that meme?
the nightmares.
Have you seen our meme page?
That's
if
true.
You haven't.
I think we have a variation of that meme on the meme page. Thanks for everyone who contributes to the meme page. It nourishes us and strengthens us. Yes.
Much like demons.
Much like the devil. So he does that meme in real life. And in doing it, realizes, wait a second. The bad dreams didn't start until I opened the box. Then the bad dreams left when I gave the box away. And he says this out loud. And he says, I've had that same dream. I don't know why I said dream. I've had that same dream. And then his sister-in-law says, I've also had that dream. And it happened.
Okay, Karen.
Karen just wants
I know
to
you
be
want to be
included.
A part of it.
You know how in-laws are. She's always felt a little out of the group. She always just wants to be accepted. And he says, did you have the dream when I gave you the box? And she says, yes. Yes, I did. Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
And this is the moment that all 30 red flags come up to meet him, and he realizes there's something weird with the box. However, it just gets worse from here.
No, you just burn it.
Well, it's interesting because he talks about that. He says,
it doesn't
burn. Well, let me finish this. We're almost done, and then I'll tell you about that. The next few weeks, the activity gets worse and worse. He puts the box in a storage unit. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
While the box is in a storage unit, which I believe is on his property, it's not like an offsite thing. It's like in the backyard or something.
Okay.
His smoke alarm inside of his house goes off, and he can't get it to turn off until he goes out and gets the box and brings it back into the house. And
why would that be the thing that pops into your mind?
Because he's starting
Maybe
to get it.
Maybe if I just bring the box he's back starting in the to get house.
It. He's starting to understand.
I don't get it. If you already opened it up, isn't it out? Why,
it's hard to say, man.
Why linger?
Again,
clearly you've been in there a while.
You have to exercise these beings. They can't just leave of their own accord, even if it's open. Even if it's open, they're still in the wood of it. Or maybe they're bound to the candlestick, or the hair, or the chalice, the cup. Who knows? Or the pennies. Penny for your thoughts?
Seems like a lot of red tape.
It is. The demon world is nothing if not inefficient. Yeah, so he brings
Never it, sign anything unless you read it more than once.
That's true. He brings it into the house, and then the smoke alarm stops. So that's good. But then once it comes in the house, his entire home for weeks is flooded with the smell of cat pee. Cat pee, quote unquote. And once again, he starts having these nightmares. The same ones. And it escalates to the point that he describes it.
Why not just take off all the smoke alarms?
I did that once.
You feel like you're living dangerously?
I did. I only did it because, like, one by one, the batteries went out, and they kept going beep, beep, beep.
Right. They started
chirping at you. Yeah, so I took them all down, took out the batteries, and said I'd put them up tomorrow, and then that was, like, 6 months, and then I put them back up. So, thankfully, nothing happened. I know it's unsafe. I do. I live dangerously. I talk about the Dybbuk, and I don't change my smoke detectors. I'm itching for trouble. Okay. Smells like piss everywhere. So there's that.
That's not the recent thing.
And then it especially with the hag nightmare, gets worse and worse until one night it's like 4 a.m. and this causes anxiety and insomnia. He finds himself sleeping less and less and less and less.
You don't say. Interesting.
Yeah. And finally he's like scrolling, in his own words, scrolling the net at 4 a.m. We know what he was doing. He was looking for some old magic. He's scrolling the net at 4 a.m. and he falls asleep just for a second. He has the nightmare. And as he opens his eyes, this is his breaking point. He opens his eyes and he sees some huge shadow run away from him. It had been right next to him. It ran away into the hallway and disappeared. And that was the moment he said he had to get rid of this. It also killed 10 of his fish. Definitely not just because he didn't feed him or anything. Also, fish smell bad.
No, they don't. Only if you don't clean it.
10 fish.
10 fish dying would smell bad.
Well, just in general, having them. They have a fishy smell.
No, they don't. I literally do not smell anything in my house.
How many fish do you have?
I have an 85-gallon aquarium.
Of how many fish?
Two.
Two fish.
Well, I guess 2 fish and a bunch of feeder fish.
Anyway, fish smell bad. The fish died.
And then they start smelling
and
bad.
Then
that's
they,
how that
sure,
works.
Whatever works. Whatever works there.
Things they, alive don't necessarily smell
killed
bad.
Killed his fish. It did, not he did. And through this, he eventually decides that the best thing to do is to find someone who would want such an item. Because he does. He talked about wanting to destroy it, but he doesn't know what he's dealing with here. He doesn't know.
You got to call in the professionals.
You got to call in the professionals.
At 4 a.m.
And where could you find such a person who had knowledge of how these boxes worked?
Craigslist.
In 2001. In 2001.
Oh, yeah.
On the internet.
Mm. AOL Instant Messenger?
eBay.
Close enough.
The Electronic Bay. In fact, everything I've told you, other than like the history of the Dybbuk, everything I've told you that has to do with Kevin Manis up to this point comes from a copy of his 2001 eBay listing.
Oh, God, Sam.
A copy of the listing, I might add, that for some reason was uploaded to genius.com.
Which is?
The lyric site. lyrics. They're lyrics. And yet, when I searched Kevin Manis eBay, I found that on genius.com. Then I found it on other sources, so I know it's not fake. I just don't know why it was on genius.com, but I'm fine with it.
It's all ridiculous.
Now, it should be worth noting, though. So first off, we know this is real. He includes pictures. We know that at least this happened, and he sold the box on the electronicbay.com. Okay? We have records of that happening. We also know that he did not set a minimum bid on the box, which is actually, in my mind, quite significant, because it's still like a nice antique box. It's still really cool. Like, if he was in this for the money, he'd at least set a minimum bid of, you know, something, but he set it at zero. And then the weirdos on the internet jumped all over it and were so excited. They bid. He finally ends up selling the box for the illustrious total of $140. So to me, the idea of like making up the story of the box to get money, on one hand, it kind of worked. Because if it is just a crappy old box, he got $140 for it.
Right.
But it just seems weird that he wouldn't start the bidding at a higher rate. I think that something happened to this person. Here's the other interesting thing about the D-Book, and it also correlates with our more modern understanding of demon possession, is that D-Book possession is almost always, in a modern clinical sense, when it's found, quote-unquote found and diagnosed, almost always occurs with some sort of mental illness, and specifically multiple personality disorder. Like, it's been noted in people in the modern day, and they show all of the signs of multiple personality disorder. To the point of, I think that Kevin might not be very well, and I'm worried about him. And that's something that's even, like, in modern publications and things like that, the two go hand in hand, the D-Book and mental illness. Now, there's definitely some of this that can't be explained by that, and so I like to come up with, like, yeah, a movie scenario where Kevin's doing all of this himself without knowing it. He's the one breaking into people's houses and peeing on their carpets. He somehow gave his mother a stroke. I don't know. That sort of a thing. But when the D-Book box is sold, and it is sold for $140 to a buyer by the name of Iosif Nitsky, who studied at Truman State University in Missouri, the story doesn't end there. And next week on this podcast, we're going to tell you what Post Malone and Adolf Hitler have in common.
They're both white?
Well, that's fair. They actually have more in common than we wanted to. Okay. Anyway, next week we're going to talk about Post Malone, Hitler, and the D-Book Box Part 2. That's what I'm trying to say.
I'm so glad this is done.
If you thought that this wasn't crazy, this was just a man missing red flags. From here on out, it gets cray.
Okay.
Ain't it, Jay?
What's your order?
D-Book Box. Anyway, that didn't rhyme. That wasn't funny.
It's Chick-fil-A.
Well, no, it's fish fillet.
Is it fish fillet?
Yeah, it's fish fillet.
It should be Chick-fil-A. I've been thinking about Chick-fil-A.
It should be Chick-fil-A.
The last 3 days, so.
Jason, what are you thinking so far?
God, murder me.
That's fair. You were right. It definitely needs to be a two-parter.
70 years being locked in a cabinet sounds great right now.
Doesn't it? Just going to alone. Bed forever.
That's called death, Sam.
True. Well, thanks for sticking with me here.
God, I didn't have much choice.
Yeah, you pretty much
I kept looking at the time.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no.
This took a minute. Yeah, so that's what we've got for this week.
Oh man, okay.
Anything you want to say? Any response right now other than God lock me in a cabinet for 70 years?
I liked Indian in the cabinet better.
Hmm. Can we still say that?
It's a book.
I guess so.
I'm referring to a book.
Yeah.
Not my fault they did that.
True. It was a good book.
It was a great book.
I don't think Katie ever read those books.
That's okay. There's a movie. There's a movie adaptation.
But if we remember, it's not the cabinet that's the magic.
No.
It's the key.
Right.
Does the key fit any lock?
I don't think so.
Somebody let us know. I'm sure someone knows. Guys, send any of your paranormal whatever, whether it's a true story a short creepypasta. One that you wrote, though. Like, I don't just want you to go to creepypasta and send it to me. Send me your creepy stories. Send me your poetry. Send me your whatever. I want our listener special to be a listener celebration of you, our people. Woo! So, other than that, we got no new reviews.
Perfect.
Because, if you might remember, we're the worst podcast of all time.
Yes.
I'm fine with that. And if anything, I think that I think that we went ahead and proved that person right. Yeah, we didn't get any new reviews this week, which is fine. We still appreciate you guys. I don't think we got any new patrons either, which is fine. That just stops us from saying woo in unison. So let me just double check
here. Who's really losing out now?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to note that we got no new patrons, and we have a lamp in the corner. That's the only thing that's on, so that worked out well.
We are sitting in the dark, aren't we?
Yep. Other than that, guys, you know, if you want to learn how to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to get involved from there. If you want to leave us an iTunes review, we love them. They're our lifeblood. If you want to make a meme for the page, that's Not Alone Podcast. No, that's Remember We're Not Alone, a community for the strange. Which is also just like a nice little community sort of thing. These are all ways to take care of us because we are tiny baby men alone in the woods. Other than that, you can find us on Facebook as well. Not Alone Podcast, Twitter, Not Alone Pod. I'm on Twitter at Beer Lord Elfbane. Elfbane, not Earthbane. Jason is at
Mighty Moit.
And yeah, you can go to notalonepodcast.com to see our blog posts that we make with every show, our show notes and our references and stuff. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com for anything other than the listener stories. Again, those go to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. It's a mouthful. Other than that, Jason did it last week. I tried to get him to do it twice last week. It didn't work, and I finally ended up cutting all of it other than just the
normal
last one.
Perfect.
I'm going to do it just once this week. Remember, whether your grandmother has a really spooky box or your mother hates her birthday gift, you are not alone.